Yes, they're called zombie businesses, the corporate undead, companies which thrive despite being largely unprofitable. During the COVID era, they seem to be multiplying, kept alive in some cases by government stimulus packages and schemes like JobKeeper. And with interest rates now at a record low, investors might be more willing to put their money into risky ventures, e-commerce, startups, health stocks and the like. It's all seen as good for the economy right now and necessary at a time when so many are struggling. But the rising tide of zombie companies, markets, economies and stocks could signal trouble down the road for investors and for governments. Writing in the Weekend Australian recently, the respected analyst Roger Montgomery from Montgomery Investment echoed the warning bells, similar to many other financial experts, a timely warning, you might say, considering that it arrives alongside the Reserve Bank's deliberate decision on low interest rates, virtually inviting people to borrow. But zombie companies, he wrote, have vast economic repercussions which have yet to be fully felt. A plague on capitalism, he said. Roger joins me now. Hello and welcome.
Great to be with you, Geraldine.
Now, you're quite passionate about this, aren't you? And yet it's not something that I think has really entered the discussion. Briefly explain what a zombie company is.
So a zombie company is simply a business that can't pay its debts from the cash flows that it generates or from its profits before interest. And there is, as you said in your introduction, there is a growing number of them. There are a number of conditions that cause them to exist. One of the conditions is eternal hope and optimism. The other one is very, very low interest rates. So if you've got low interest rates and they're so low that they're close to zero, people are more inclined to speculate on companies that may make a profit in the very distant future, even though they're not making one now. The consequences are quite serious because, of course, these businesses require labour, they require people, and many of the staff that they employ probably don't realise that the business is being funded by altruistic shareholders and lenders rather than the profits of the business.
You can see, when you explain it like this, exactly why people rush to real estate, can't you? Because they feel they understand it, because they're living amongst it, etc., and they form views. I mean, it is really quite demanding looking, you know, especially with a lot of the health stocks I see, that's a real area where I think there's got to be real progress made. But, gee, it's hard to discern what's really likely, in my opinion.
There's a difference between investing and speculating, and as long as an investor understands that difference, they'll be okay. They'll allocate an appropriate amount of money to the speculative assets, and it's a smaller amount. But I agree with you, biotechnology, artificial intelligence, these are all very, very high-risk speculative ventures. And the fact of the matter is, if interest rates were at 10%, for example, and or even 6 or 7%, you would think very carefully about taking those risks on because you don't need to. But when interest rates are zero, there's a lot more risk being adopted without real concern for the consequences.
People will be listening and saying, yes, but we know from reading the financial press that every now and then people make a killing from just that, from getting in when no one else appears to get in, when money is cheap, and somebody whom they're backing has got this brilliant idea that no one's ever thought of before.
Indeed. And because interest rates have been so low, there has been an appetite to invest in these high-risk ventures, and that has funded the boom in technology that we've seen, whether it's artificial intelligence or electric vehicles or autonomous vehicles or 3D printing. The common cause or the common link is these very, very low interest rates, making money very cheap to risk, and low rates are also obviously quite punitive. So there's a government incentive to disincentivize saving and get people to move their money out of the bank and into other things and push
but
the prices
that,
of those assets
might,
up.
Mightn't that be good to have the money moving around? Isn't that, don't we need to have it moving?
Yes, no, that's absolutely right. You do want to increase the velocity of money. You want people spending. But I just wonder whether or not there's a problem with the way the government's gone about doing it. So lower interest rates, that's fine. The Reserve Bank of Australia brings interest rates very, very low. The government hands out money for people to go and spend, and that supports business. business. That's great. But what it also does is it fuels speculation in things that might never make any money. So therefore, what it does is it funds a misdirection or a misallocation of resources. And so at some point down the track, if the yield curve, if the bond yield curve starts to steepen and bond rates start to go up, even if central banks around the world are keeping the overnight cash rate very low, if bond rates start to go up, then people will start to say, investors will start to say, you know what? I don't mind putting my money in for 10 years at 3 or 4 or 5%. That's a darn sight better, and there's very little risk that the Australian government's not going to pay me back. So I'll put my money there, and then the reverse happens. They take their money out of risk assets.
Then you get a flight of capital.
Indeed, and risk assets start to fall. And so people who've invested in the business that was never going to make any money, that business is now worthless. And all the people employed by that business gets sacked as well. And so you end up with a lingering problem.
So just to be clear, in a way you're saying, if to really sort of distill it, that the various protections offered to businesses during the pandemic, for instance, has blurred the line, are you saying, between a good investment and a risky one?
Indeed. Unless you're a professional investor, there's very little information to help guide you as to what is a quality investment and what is a high-risk investment. And all of them have been going up. And because all of them have been going up, it's self-reinforcing. Everybody pats themselves on the back and says, aren't I a smart investor? I bought this thing and look at it now. It's gone up. But when the circumstances change, and I'm not suggesting I have a crystal ball and I know when that's going to happen. I don't. But circumstances inevitably will change. And when the price of money goes up, when the cost of borrowing or the return for investing in cash rises, then suddenly people are going to realise they took out a lot more risk for very little return. Warren Buffett famously once said, it's only when the tide goes out that you see who was swimming naked.
Yes. I mean, you cite Uber as a zombie company, which I think might shock a lot of people. It employs thousands and provides much-needed income. I mean, on the face of it, again, you might say, well, it deserves support because it is spreading money around a lot of little people.
Yeah, I think that's a very dangerous thing to advocate. I think we have to let capitalism take its course because otherwise we don't learn from our mistakes. And while there are serious consequences from that, we don't end up resetting the compass and starting again. And that's why we're in the problem that we're in with these perpetually low interest rates and very low returns on people's savings. It's because we've been too scared to let companies go broke, and that's why we're supporting these zombie companies. So many years ago, you might remember, Geraldine, we had the Asian currency crisis. The Asian banks and many Southeast Asian nations approached the World Bank and they approached Western democratic countries and asked them what they should do. It was widely viewed as inappropriate for those countries to be bailed out. They were told, have a recession, let your companies go broke and start again and you'll emerge stronger later on. And that's exactly what happened. But when Western nations faced the same dilemma, we didn't take that advice, so we started quantitative easing.
It's a pretty harsh it's a very harsh old prescription though, isn't it? Because millions of people go backwards and often never recover. I mean, it's that is a harsh prescription.
Yes, and I'm not advocating it, but the situation we've got ourselves into at the moment is that people are going backwards because they're earning nothing on their term deposits. They don't want to take risk, and inflation is higher than the interest rate they're earning on their term deposit, so that in 12 months' time or 24 months' time, their dollar buys less than what it bought today. So they're in fact going backwards, even though it doesn't look like it.
So how do you think this zombification should be tackled then? I mean, are there any solutions? And this is really now, isn't it? People are really having money thrown at them now. A lot of us are having to assess this sort of thing. And obviously with, you know, is real estate, I mean, it's sort of depressing if real estate's the only way that you can sort of take a risk. What would you do?
Well, unfortunately, it's impossible for governments to frame a policy in time for the next election and take the credit for it. So, you know, a three-year election cycle doesn't allow this to happen. But what would be ideal is not just the disclosure regime we have for warning people about risk, but actually some sort of platform that explained the difference between a quality investment and a risky investment, so people could appropriately weight their investments into those things. So at the moment, we have a regime where a company might say, for example, you could lose all your money in this investment. We're not sure whether it's going to be successful or not. Now you've been informed. And that's all we need to do. And we can start raising money on that basis. That reminds me, many years ago, during the tech boom in 1999, there was a company called NetJ.com, and in its prospectus, it listed in the United States, it was a backdoor listing, but it said to its investors, NetJ.com conducts no substantial activity of any description, and NetJ.com has no plans of conducting any substantial business activity of any description in the foreseeable future. And so that's the disclosure regime. They've told everyone what they're not doing in that case, and you're free to invest in it.
And did they? Did people invest?
They were oversubscribed. They bought shares at 50 cents. They listed at just over $2 a share. They subsequently rose to $8.88 a share, and then they went down to about 6 cents and were delisted. And true to label, they never conducted any business activity of any description. That's the regime we're in. We're in a regime where as long as the risks are disclosed, you're free to invest in it. My concern is that the self-reinforcing nature of rising asset prices has given people a false sense of confidence investing in things that don't make any money and may never make any money, and then they'll end up licking their wounds down the track.
So what do people do? Final question then. How do you suddenly learn how to become a better investor? Do I have to take advice, do I, which means people like you?
Well, no, not necessarily. I think there's two groups, there's two stakeholders that really need to be concerned about this. One, of course, is the investors, and sound advice can often help. You need to know basic things. Does this company make a profit? You mentioned Uber earlier on. Geraldine, if I said to you, I've got this business idea, we are going to lose billions and billions of dollars over the next 12 years, and at the end of 12 years, we still might not make any money, and I'm not sure that we're going to be successful, but please give me billions of dollars, would you? You would probably say no. Well, Uber's raised over $20 billion, $24 or $26 billion over the last 12 years, and it's never made a profit. And it's not making a profit today. So there's two stakeholders in that need to be concerned. One is the investor. What happens if interest rates go up and this all unwinds and reverses? And the other stakeholder are the employees. Do I want to be working in a startup environment when interest rates go up and the tap that is funding this business is turned off? Because that will happen when interest rates become more attractive. And at that point, there will be an issue for the government to deal with in terms of unemployment.
So anyway, when you're doing your research, really make a very reasonable assessment of when, and ask them, when do they expect to start turning a profit?
That's right. And if they've given milestones for that, make sure they hit those milestones or exceed them.
Very interesting. I can see why you call it a plague on society and capitalism, but it does take a bit to understand. Thank you very much indeed, Roger.
Always a pleasure.
Roger Montgomery, a columnist for the Australian newspaper and the founder and chief investment officer at Montgomery Investment Management. And one of our texters has said, this economist wants the mass of people to suffer as we did in the 90s so that a minority gets to profit. Evil. Well, of course, this is the whole debate around capitalism and in terms of, you know, how you do limit the casualties and yet do have elements of dynamism. I mean, it's an endless debate.